I'm Frank Vaughn. It's April 23rd, 2025, and as we continue our journey through the mind of Mark Carney, it is going to get more interesting from here. The first two parts of this series were basically introductory. It's now getting into the meat and potatoes, and you will understand him far better as we go. I want to make it clear before we start reading quotes from the book that you need to understand as a backdrop that Mark Carney views you as little people to be taken care of from on high by the technocracy. And if you step out of line, this is the article that he penned in the Globe and Mail, it's time to end the sedition in Ottawa by enforcing the law and following the money. Full prosecution, seizure of bank accounts on his advice, extrajudicially, and even though the Emergencies Act was found to have been misapplied, as I've said before, nobody went to jail, nobody was held accountable, Mark Carney thought it was an appropriate response to people protesting for their charter rights. And before we continue this deep dive, I just want to do one more note of housekeeping, because the normal function of these videos is to cover the day's events and also do deep dives into the things that underlie those events, and it's been kind of on pause since we're doing this book review. There are those who are concerned that the Conservative Party didn't mention guns in their platform release and that they will not repeal the order in council. I am so confident that they will do what they've already said that they would do that I'd be willing to take a $10,000 note on a line of credit and put it in escrow that if they form a government, they will repeal those order in councils if anybody else wants to take the other side of that bet. That's how confident I am. I would borrow money and put a bet on it. So put it out of your mind. Onwards with the book. The quote that's on the screen is a bit out of order, but we'll just get rid of it anyway because it's here. Trichet's colleague didn't wait, but went straight back to Frankfurt to join the ECB's initiative, unprecedented at the time, to pump billions of euros of liquidity into their money markets because he sensed that by tomorrow, all would have been lost. All would have been lost for big finance, for the banks, for many of his buddies. And when he talks about liquidity, just swap in your mind cash. Liquidity is cash. Cash from nothing that Carney feels it is a central bank's duty to print whenever big finance is under threat. Another quote from page 134. I was working at Canada's Department of Finance after a long career on Wall Street and in the city. Now, what's the city? It's the city of London. It's a part of Great Britain, but it's governed separately. It has its own rights. It has its own privileges. And it is the heart of darkness in the world for captured capitalism, if you want to call it, or captured finance that works against you, the people. Just so you have an idea of where he comes from. He talks about the gilded halls, and he talks about all the globalists that he hobnobs with and printing billions of dollars like they're nothing, as though it's part of his normal day, because it is. That's who he is. He's forgotten his roots, whatever they were. He is now a global financier. Another quote, to put it in context, the Canadian commercial paper market was small. Note what he describes as small. Jamie was talking about a $30 billion corner dwarfed by the $500 billion government debt and $1.5 trillion in equities. Now, government debt is now well north of $1 trillion, and he wants to add another $200 billion to it. We are actually approaching the $1.5 trillion number in terms of debt that he's talking about here in terms of the net value of equities. But I digress. He has no issue with these numbers because he's lost all sense of scale. You paying your rent or you paying your bills, that's not even, it doesn't register except as a theory or a concept in this man's mind, because the numbers that he plays with, first off, are huge. Second of all, they're unlimited because he commands the money printers. That's his perspective on money. Early on in my career in finance, I was taught an invaluable rule by Bob Hurst, one of the partners at Goldman Sachs. If something doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. Beneath the Popeye-esque tautology was real wisdom. Bob's point was that if someone explains something to you in finance, such as a flashy new product, or why a company's valuation should be orders of magnitude higher than others in their sector, and it doesn't make sense, ask the person to repeat the rationale, and following that response, it still doesn't make sense, you should run. Run, because in finance, you should never buy simply on trust, just go along with the crowd, or least of all, to pretend that you understand something for fear of looking foolish. Run, because there are really only two possibilities. The first is that you're being sold something that really doesn't make sense. It's merely a form of financial alchemy in which debt is being turned into equity. The newest version of the mythical risk-free return, or the latest variant of the four most expensive words in the English language. This time is different. He literally describes at the end of this book how this time is different when he's talking about finance. When he talks about debt being turned into equity and how you should run the other way, that's exactly what he does when he works for central banks. He turns debt by printing money into equity by putting it on the balance sheets of banks and bailing them out. This is what I'm talking about. He speaks out of both sides of his mouth. He sucks and blows at the same time. You cannot trust a man who does this and does it pathologically. And that is one of the key here. This is pathological. It is a pathology. It is a pattern of behavior that is intrinsic. It's almost a heuristic of his nature. Now, you're about to see the man behind the curtain. To begin with, they are a critical part of the payment system. He's talking here about commercial banks. The pipes through which financial transactions occur by facilitating Adam Smith's decentralized exchange. The payment system is critical to the functioning of a market economy. It passes unnoticed unless it breaks down, and it's one of the jobs of central banks to oversee systemic elements of the payment system to ensure its reliability. Remember, just previously, he casts aspersion on using debt to create equity, even though that's exactly what the banking system does. It's not just the central banks, it's the commercial banks as well. And he talks about it being a decentralized exchange. There's nothing decentralized about the banking system. Not here in Canada, not in many parts of the world. It's a little bit more decentralized in the United States, but can you really say that when the central bank oversees all, literally has the power of God within the market to create and to remove banks, to create and to remove markets? Listen to how he describes the bank's function, and remember, he thinks this is normal and good and that it can't be better than this. It might be able to be better regulated, but this is the ideal infrastructure of a functioning market, a functioning money system. Banks hold short-term liquid reserves that are only a fraction of their outstanding obligation. If one depositor wants their money back, this isn't a problem because banks maintain sufficient liquidity to meet typical demands and can borrow from other banks if the shock is larger than anticipated. Or at the end of the day, the central bank can step in with freshly printed money because the banks have overextended themselves. They don't have the money to return the money to depositors. He thinks this is a normal function. Central banks act as lenders of last resort to solvent but illiquid institutions. I have such a problem with this statement. How can something be solvent if it can't meet the obligations of its creditors? If your business cannot pay the bills, if your business has run out of money, are you solvent or are you insolvent? How can you be solvent but illiquid? It doesn't make sense to me. Maybe I'm just a rube. Banks perform a third essential role of credit intermediation, channeling funds from savers to investors in the real economy. Yes. If you have $10,000 in the bank, you go into that bank and you try and get your $10,000, it's going to be a rigmarole. You're probably not going to get it, not in cash form. You might be able to get a money order to electronically, because a money order is just a paper version of electronic data entry. You might be able to get a money order to move it from one account to another, but you're not going to be able to get physical cash with it, and you're not going to be able to initiate a debit transaction. You're probably limited to only $1,000 at a time. And that's because they've taken your savings, they've loaned it out to people, and they make profit on that. And they don't just loan out your savings, they loan out an amount of money in excess of what they have on the books. So your money's gone as soon as you put it in a bank. You have a claim on it. You have a claim to get it back. There is depositor's insurance up to $100,000. But if it was put to the test by a genuine bank run, the entire system would collapse, which is why the central banks step in and print all kinds of new money, robbing you of the power, the purchasing power of the money in your pocket, robbing you of the purchasing power of the savings that you have at the bank that you can't even get because they are loaning it out and making vast amounts of money off it, and they give you like a 0.25% on your savings account. It should be criminal, but it's not. Banking, back to the book, is fundamentally about intermediation, connecting borrowers and savers in the real economy. Now, I know many people will say, Polyev's not going to do anything about central banking. Donald Trump's not doing anything about central banking. The Federal Reserve still exists. The Bank of Canada still exists as it is. That's not the point. The point is, this man is a central banker and believes that the central banks basically can't make mistakes, even though he plays lip service to it. Read this quote. In response to rising competitive pressure from markets, banks increasingly became direct participants in them in ways that ultimately sowed the seeds of the crisis. It's not the bank's fault. It's the market. You're going to see this over and over again throughout this book, that he assesses blame to the operation of markets. Actually, it's not highlighted, but right below it. First, banks relied more and more on short-term markets to fund their activities, and in the process, substantially boosted their leverage. So again, there's a shift of blame to the short-term markets, to the market itself, money and capital markets, not the activities of the bank themselves. They're victims of the market. They're victims. They're to fund the over-leverage, whereby they lend in excess of depositors. They relied on markets which were unregulated. It's not the fault of the basic operation of the bank. It's not the fault of the structure of central banks in our economy and the way our money works, the infrastructure. Here's another one. They held on to AAA tranches of complex structures that proved far from risk-free. Now, what he's talking about there is in the financial crisis, your credit card debt, your mortgages were packaged up into tranches, which is just a collection of debts, and then they were sold off to various people on the market. And the hope was you paid a premium for that collection of debt, and in the process of it being paid back, you would make a profit on the spread. So there's interest payments being accrued on all that debt. Your lives, essentially, are being packaged and sold around by people who have a lot more money than you and have the ability to print money out of thin air, to loan in excess of depositors. And at the end of the day, if the whole thing goes bust, they can go to the central bank who will print money and give it to them. You lose everything. But he calls them AAA tranches. If you've watched, what's that movie? The Big Short. If you watch The Big Short, it's actually a really good movie. There's a couple things I could take issue with. But you'll learn in the movie, and if you read books on the financial crisis, these weren't AAA tranches at all. The ratings were fake. They were being rated fake. They were garbage. They were junk. Now, he comes close to the truth here. In many banks, a culture that rewarded innovation and opacity over risk management and transparency undermined organizations more than originally thought. Because it wasn't the market and the operating of the market that created the crisis, but the immoral and unethical behavior of banks and finance. Just as banks began doing what markets traditionally did best, markets moved into banking. So right below this quote, there's another quote that once again shifts the blame to the market. Overall, that's the entire thesis. The market is at fault, not the behavior of the banks, not the lack of morality, not the lack of accountability, because like I said, very few people went to jail relative to how many people got scammed, and they all got to keep their big bonuses while the plebs lost everything. When he talks about the central bank stepping in and propping up the market and saving everybody, he didn't save the people. He saved his friends. He saved the people who got those million-dollar bonuses. It's incredible how he can do this, how he can write this, how he can believe this, and you should know this before you make this man prime minister. This quote's going to sound like gobbledygook, but I think it's necessary. Issuance of collateralized debt obligations, securities composed of pooled collections of various debt grew sixfold, while issuance of collateralized debt obligations, squared pooled collections of other CDOs grew 11-fold. So this is, to make it simple, those tranches that I was talking about, all of your debts being packaged up and sold off so that people could make money off of your blood and bad decisions, who was responsible for the creation and inflation of this market? It wasn't the market. It was the actors. It was the banks. It was finance. They created these circumstances. So, which this is interesting. Lesson in Crisis Management is the subtitle. During the following year, I would learn a great deal about financial crisis management from Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, Hank Paulson, Christine Lagarde, Mario Draghi, and Jean-Claude Trichet, the very people who were overseeing all of this while it happened, of course, were the ones who managed the crisis in a form of problem reaction solution. Turning a blind eye, as it was created, they stepped in, and he is learning his lessons in crisis management from the very people who created and oversaw the crisis. Again, this is the name dropping of all the World Economic Forum people, all of the globalists, all the billionaire class, the oligarchs. This is where he learned his most valuable lessons over and over and over again. He name drops them and talks about what they taught him. The very people who oversaw the creation of the very crisis they are responding to. Now recall the article that I shared that he wrote for the Globe and Mail at the beginning of this video talking about using overwhelming force against the Freedom Convoy and targeting everybody's finances, following the money, maximum usage of force. The quote from the book is talking about the crisis. This leads to the final lesson I learned about managing crises: the importance of overwhelming force. The italics are his, not mine. Fighting a financial fire with half measures is futile, whether it was Hank Paulson's $750 billion bazooka in 2008, printed at your expense, printed with the guarantee of the taxpayer, and the taxpayer never got to say whether they wanted to guarantee that money or not, printed out of thin air, so it double robs you. It's hard to remain composed because you're getting robbed twice. Not only do you have to underwrite it as a taxpayer, so your future tax dollars backstop this printing, they robbed you of the value of your own money when they printed this and threw it into the markets. And he's talking about management, crisis management, like he's some kind of hero, like these guys are heroes. Whether it was Hank Paulson's $750 billion bazooka in 2008 or Mario Draghi's whatever it takes pledge, a few years later at the height of the euro crisis, effective crisis fighting measures need to be massive, top-down, technocratic, massive spending at your expense, massive printing at the backstop of the taxpayer, and overwhelming control and authority by the state and by the technocrats that exist above and beyond the state, because that's also what we're talking about. When he uses the term independent central bank, he means independence from interference of the people and their representatives in their respective houses of government. Back to the book, the UK government was injecting enormous capital into a number of its banks and all but nationalizing the largest one, RBS. In discussions with Ben Bernanke, then Bank of England Governor Mervyn King, and Jean-Claude Trichet, we formed the view that central banks needed to conduct an unprecedented coordinated 50 basis point interest rate. So in these not-so-smoky room, because smoking is banned everywhere indoors these days, so the whole smoky room analogy doesn't work anymore, these guys are moving your lives around like pawns on a chessboard. You're nothing but numbers and statistics to them. He asks, what if the Bank of Canada's actions laid bare that the government's position on the economy was untenable? Could the actions of an independent, apolitical central bank influence an election? Well, yeah, of course. And Mark Carney doesn't have a problem with this because as central bank governor in England, he got involved in Brexit. And in this case, some would say he helped push Stephen Harper over the top by getting involved. But the thing that is issuous with this statement is the idea of independent apolitical central bank. In an ideal world, they're apolitical. But in practice, there's nothing apolitical about a central bank, especially under Mark Carney's management, because he has no problem getting involved. Look at what's happening now. This is the mind of a banker. He has, I guess, an economist's mind, but this is his frame of reference. He wants to apply that frame of reference to the office of Prime Minister here in Canada. He is actually your prime minister, your unelected prime minister right now. I can't think of a more dangerous person to put at the head of government than a central banker. I'm not sure how the left has missed this. These people who have been fighting oligarchs their entire lives are now unifying around a central banker whose history is one of destructive money printing. Back to Mark Carney, the world economy was on the brink. The focus turned to the only thing that mattered, saving what was left of the financial system to prevent a depression. Saving what was left of the financial system. Not the people, not the plebs, losing their homes, losing everything, losing their livelihoods, losing their jobs, but the financial system. It's the verbiage. You can see where the priority is. A consensus was forged that governments and central banks would unequivocally backstop our banking systems with liquidity and capital if necessary. Liquidity and capital are used separately here, but they're largely the same thing. What we're talking about is cash, electronic money out of nothing, and they were willing to backstop, which means print and inject money directly into the hands of the banks. Not you, not the user, not the poor depositor who loses all their money, not the depositor who can't get their money back out of the system. Like, I guess there's a world where you can go and you can get a money order from one institution and move it to another institution. And the central bank printing money would allow you to do that because they'd run out of the banks had spent themselves out of money, so they didn't have money to return your money to you. So the central bank steps in, prints money so that you can get your money back out. But the money that you put in has been devalued by the money printing, so you're getting less anyway. If your $10,000 can buy a car when you put it in at $10,000, but when you take it back out, it takes $12,000 or $13,000 to buy the same car, you have lost, maybe not money, but you've lost value. And again, this is standard operating procedure for these people. The G20 was a young forum to socialize these pillars of globalization across the membership. He loves globalization and supranational bodies. You don't vote for the G20. Your elected representatives attend. You don't vote for anybody at the World Economic Forum. It's just composed of technocrats. You don't vote for central bank governors. You don't vote for these masters of the universe who make much more important decisions than your own elected government representatives. They steer the world, they control the world, and as this book highlights, they view themselves as the appropriate rulers and masters of the universe, that they're the only ones that can make sound decisions with their racket. And he doesn't even waste time talking about representing the people. It's all about finance and banking and saving banks and finance and saving money and serving money. And at the same time as he can, as I've previously shown, defame money, defame the market, defame all these things. His whole existence is in service to rigging the game for the benefit of his banks, his friends, his scions of finance. Back to Carney. As I headed into a hastily convened meeting of the G20, I knew that such light-touch, laissez-faire thinking was dead. Free markets are responsible for the crisis. The world had moved from G1 to G0. Could the system survive without a hegemon? Only if it could rediscover its values. What values? Well, this is where it gets interesting. The values that largely he seems to have drawn from Marx. Words like diversity, inclusion, equity, all of these concepts which he approaches and handles like I said before, a fish trying to describe the world of a primate, creating a simpler, safer, fairer financial system. The G20 was empowered to lead the reform of the global financial system. It charged a new body, the Financial Stability Board, with these tasks and had it report directly to the G20 leaders, thereby providing the essential political backing. It was my privilege to help lead those efforts as the successor to the FSB's first chair, Mario Draghi. So, once again, the very people who were present during the creation of the crisis were the ones that were tasked in a new technocratic body, a new unelected, overseeing, masters of the universe modeled board of directors of people, and they were the ones that led it. And Mark Carney is so well positioned within the oligarchical class that he was its second chair. Once again, Mark Carney, faith in markets reigns supreme. It's the market's fault. risks in the financial system were increasingly ignored. Few masters of the universe, self-described, were focused on the longer-term consequences of their actions. The future arrived with a bang from the Great Moderation to the Great Recession. What was moderate about the lead-up to the financial crisis? From boom to bust, from confidence to mistrust, the consequences were severe. A lost decade. Real household incomes in the UK did not grow at all over the 10 years following the fall of Northern Rock. This was the worst performance since Karl Marx was scribbling the Communist Manifesto in the British Library. Why does he bring up Karl Marx so much? I mean, the answer is self-evident. But the interesting thing here is he talks about the lost decade. It was lost for the people. It was lost for the plebs. It wasn't lost for finance. Mark never missed a meal. Ben Bernanke never missed a meal. All of the people who are making the decisions to save the world, which they failed to do, never lost anything. All they did was gain. And he's here talking about this as though it is a public good. Back to Carney, the restrictions prompted by the COVID crisis will, at a minimum, make these trends harder to reverse and could intensify them. In italics, growing mistrust of the elites. The financial crisis was arguably one of the main causes of the marked decline in the trust in experts. Wonder of wonders. The people who got screwed don't trust the people who did the screwing. A financial system lauded by most economists and policymakers, as well as by all bankers, came crashing down on the heads of ordinary people, some of whom are still suffering the consequences. They, like Queen Elizabeth, wondered, why did no one notice it? The answer, according to a letter addressed to Her Majesty and signed by 33, interesting number, distinguished economists, was a failure of the collective imagination of many bright people, both in this country and internationally, to understand the risks to the system as a whole. They were engaged in massive profit-taking for themselves. They were engaged in something that should have been criminal, yet few ever faced liability for those criminal actions. And they have the nerve to sit here and feel sorry for themselves because the public has declining trust in experts. The experts who have been screwing them every way from Sunday. Do you not think the plebs have a right to their skepticism? Especially in light of all the things we've learned since COVID-19, which the entire world has just moved on from. There are still people that you can find on X who insist it's airborne, it's a threat, it's coming for you. People have never taken their mask off. Their minds are broken. They've completely lost the script and all perspective, and the damage to families because of the panic, because of the lockdowns, because of the people who died alone, the people who lost their jobs. It's layer upon layer of expert damage caused to ordinary people, and they have the audacity. He has the audacity to sit here and lament it. Here's another one of those interesting inversions. And for a while, the rapid expansion of leverage, which is printing in excess of what you have on hand, helped fuel stronger growth and greater economic dynamism. But much of this growth would prove ephemeral because in the process of growing market fundamentalism, again, growing market fundamentalism, the market, finance lost track of its core values of fairness, integrity, prudence, and responsibility. So right here, he's rightly ascribing the problem to finance, but in the pretext, he sets it up as the problem of the process of market fundamentalism. It's so interesting to me. They formed a new body, we talked about this already, the Financial Stability Board, and charged it with fixing the fault lines that had caused the crisis. The FSB brought together the heads of the central banks, securities regulators, and treasuries from the world's largest economies, along with those running the major standard-setting bodies. Under the skillful and energetic leadership of Mario Draghi, the FSB had an immediate impact in shaping and giving shape to a more resilient financial system. A decade after the crisis, global banks' misconduct cost had exceeded $320 billion, capital that could otherwise have supported around $5 trillion of lending to households and businesses. The only thing that you should get out of those three quotes is that lending in excess, lying, manipulation, created the great financial crisis. So they established a new board of people, board of experts, who were tasked with fixing the problem that they created. So they implemented some changes And here it is, a decade later, and they are still lending. He's lamenting the fact that there were $320 billion in losses to the financial sector due to misconduct costs. So the price that they paid for doing things wrong. But his lamentation isn't the misconduct. It's that there's a loss of leveraged lending to the tune of $5 trillion. So his concern is that the $320 billion wasn't used to create leverage to the tune of $5 trillion. Can you believe it? Do you think that anything has been fixed? Or is the next crisis right around the corner? In light of the housing market bubble here in Canada, in light of the inflationary printing that went on in the wake of COVID, did they actually learn anything? This whole book is filled with references to how they're learning and they're evolving. Except the exact same force that has been, by the way, they've been doing this since the invention of central banking. Boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. It's the calling card. Nothing's changed. And yet he's writing a book about how things have changed at the same time as describing how things have not changed. And now he wants to run your country. Back to the book, a financial system that can better serve households and businesses in bad times as well as good. A system that can help support greater inclusion in the transition to a net zero carbon economy. Now, you're 170-odd pages into the book, and this concept of net zero, which is the most important theme of this book, is just barely being introduced. But for now, let's focus on this financial system that can better serve households. However, more than $30 trillion of assets are held in funds that promise daily liquidity to investors despite investing in potentially illiquid underlying assets. This liquidity mismatch creates an advantage to investors who redeem ahead of others, particularly in stress. This first mover advantage could prompt a destabilizing rush for the exits. So right there, he admits all the problems that he's discussed to this point still exist in fundamentally the exact same ways and are still being governed and overseen by the exact same people and the exact same mindset, more importantly, that's passed down through the generations, not just the 2008 crisis, but long before. Mismatches between redemption terms and the liquidity of some funds' assets means there is an advantage to investors who redeem ahead of others. Again, in a bank run, the only people who win, or in a run on the markets, because we have this thing called market cap in stocks and in crypto and in many other things, the market cap of housing. And the thing is that if everybody tries to redeem, that is dump, at the same time, the market cap vanishes well before the, let me try this again. If everybody who has Apple stock decides to sell at the same time, they're not all getting the price of Apple stock that's currently quoted on any stock ticker that you'll find. As soon as someone starts selling, the price of the stock falls. So the company's not actually worth its worth its market valuation or its market cap. These are fake fantasy numbers that actually have no bearing on reality, and I am not sure why we're obsessed with them. A lot of people in finance talk about market cap. It's just a fake number. It doesn't mean anything because if everybody tries to sell, the value collapses long before anybody can redeem anything close to what the market cap was quoted when the selling started. So this is a problem that continues. If the experience of the financial and COVID crisis teaches anything, it's humility. Has anything in the last three videos described a humble person using overwhelming force to target people who protest COVID restrictions and want to defend their charter and taking away their ability to conduct finance, to interact with banks, to be able to spend and pay and to work and all of the other evils that came out of 2021 and 2022, or the evils thus described in 2008 where everybody lost their shirt and they printed all the money and they bailed out their banks and they bailed out finance and they did it without your permission or even bothering to consult with you. They only consulted among the experts who created the crisis. Does any of that sound humble to you? This from his own mouth. They privatized profits during the credit boom and socialized the losses when the music stopped. He uses the term they. He was they. The complete loss of confidence in private finance that crystallized in the autumn of 2008 could be arrested only by public support. Public support. Public support. Not voluntary. Imposed. Public support meaning your governments using you as collateral on money that they printed and then injected without even consulting you. Over the following year that totaled $15 trillion in bailouts, government guarantees of bank liabilities, and special central bank liquidity schemes, it's all about saving the rich at the expense of the poor. What is the left doing? When I was a young man, 20 years old, 19 years old, I was a liberal. I identified as liberal. I thought the left was the way to go. Now, I had some wake-up calls when I went and I protested the invasion of Iraq. The fact that the Marxist-Leninist daily was being sold all along the protest route and the communists had a strong presence really kind of triggered something in my mind and started causing some reflection and examination. But the bottom line is, I used to subscribe to Zed Magazine, and I read Noam Chomsky, and I was versed in all these publications, and there was, I always had questions about it. But the fact is, back then, we were challenging the oligarchy. We were challenging the central bankers. We were talking about this stuff and protesting this stuff. Now the left has so changed that their hero, their unifying figurehead, is a central banker that robbed all of them. This from his own mouth. They privatized profits during the credit boom and socialized the losses when the music stopped. He uses the term they. He was they. The complete loss of confidence in private finance that crystallized in the autumn of 2008 could be arrested only by public support. Public support. Public support. Not voluntary. Imposed. Public support meaning your governments using you as collateral on money that they printed and then injected without even consulting you. Over the following year that totaled $15 trillion in bailouts, government guarantees of bank liabilities, and special central bank liquidity schemes, it's all about saving the rich at the expense of the poor. What is the left doing? When I was a young man, 20 years old, 19 years old, I was a liberal. I identified as liberal. I thought the left was the way to go. Now, I had some wake-up calls when I went and I protested the invasion of Iraq. The fact that the Marxist-Leninist daily was being sold all along the protest route and the communists had a strong presence really kind of triggered something in my mind and started causing some reflection and examination. But the bottom line is, I used to subscribe to Zed Magazine, and I read Noam Chomsky, and I was versed in all these publications, and there was, I always had questions about it. But the fact is, back then, we were challenging the oligarchy. We were challenging the central bankers. We were talking about this stuff and protesting this stuff. Now the left has so changed that their hero, their unifying figurehead, is a central banker that robbed all of them. And now listen to this one. By replacing the implicit privilege of powerful banks with the full discipline of the market, social capital can be rebuilt and economic dynamism increased. So he just spent 100 plus pages blaming the market and the interactions of the market for the problem. Now he invokes the full discipline of the market and says that they're going to replace the implicit privilege of powerful banks, while in the previous pages he describes the exercise of the implicit privilege of the banks, which exists to this day. Another quote, COVID was a large test, as large a test as could be imagined. Major UK banks passed. The government printed money again. Now, some of that money, for once, ended up in the hands of the plebs. But in the exercise of creating that money in those programs out of thin air, who paid but those who lost value in their assets and in their savings? It created the inflation crisis, which we talk about right now. It created the incredible housing market bubble here in Canada. There's a lot of reasons underlying that. But at the same time, as they were printing all this money to deal with a crisis that, by the way, they largely created. COVID was a highly survivable respiratory infection. It mainly targeted, and you'll see that Mark Carney recognizes this, its main targets were the elderly and those with comorbidities. If you were young and healthy, you survived it like you would survive a cold. Some people got sicker, yes, but the argument that there was a need to lock down the entire economy, shut the entire global economy down, and engage in massive money printing, which is basically euchred anybody that didn't own anything. It's very hard for you to own anything now because of the consequences of what they did. COVID didn't create the crisis. The government response did. And in my work, even back when I didn't know how deadly COVID was going to be, it looked pretty bad coming out of China. The one thing that I did know is that the government and the central banks, when they responded to it, would create far more destruction, that it was them that I was afraid of, and it was them that you should prepare against. And here he is saying that they passed the test. Look around you. Is the world better than it was in 2019? And furthermore, was the world of 2019 better than the world of 2008? It's a cycle that just keeps repeating, and the only people who win are these guys. When I set out to do this book review, I wasn't expecting it to be the thorough study that it has turned into, and I wasn't expecting it to turn into a multi-part series just on one book, but I think it's important. If this man becomes prime minister, these videos, for as long as they're allowed to be online, because they will probably be targeted very quickly by legislation the liberals will introduce regulating the internet even further than they already are, at least there will be some kind of testament to the fact that he wrote a book highlighting his worldview and how out of sync it is with the needs of ordinary people, all the while he pretends to be virtuous and be concerned primarily with the needs of ordinary people, when all of his actions that he details have nothing to do with you. He admits, as I've just shown, that you got screwed and that his buddies kept on running the world. It's kind of incredible. And furthermore, I think that most people in their time on Earth will never read a book like this. In my life, I've read several of their books. I've read the works of the globalists themselves so that I can understand what they think. Most people would get outraged and quit. They're probably smarter for it, because I'll tell you, digging through this book was actually quite depressing for me, because I realized that these are the ones that are in control and I'm down here just trying to expose a level of that control with very limited resources. They have unlimited resources. They control the media. They control the government. They control money printing and issuance. The very money that I need to pay my bills exists because of their power. So we're at a supreme disadvantage down here, especially when we don't play by the rules and by the typical game plan. But I feel this is worthwhile all the same. And so there's going to be more parts. And I'm going to, regardless of whether or not I finish looking at the book, I'm just looking at the calendar, this is all going to be wrapped up by Sunday. Whatever's left unsaid will be left unsaid. But until then, until the election, I think it's worthwhile to pursue this, because there's millions of people out there who haven't voted yet. And quite honestly, if I can even reach a handful of them, this has been worthwhile. I'm Frank Vaughn. If you like the work, please consider supporting it. You can do monthly $5-$10 a month, or you can do one-time donations. April's been dead. Very low participation in April, which I understand. April's tax season. Everybody's broke. You're all paying taxes. So the guys like Mark Carney can just keep on printing and just keep on ruling, and the technocracy can just keep ticking on. They can eat their caviar and drink their champagne, and you and I are left down here in the mud, trying to scrape out a living. I'll see you in the next one.